FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and it's May 24th, 2018. And, well, got some good stories here. But as always, make my day. Send me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. So Danielle Park is with us, just talking with Danielle about a story. Parents are suing their 30-year-old son after he refuses to move out. I mean, I guess the age of subtlety, I think it was Sam Zell wrote that book, Am I Being Subtle Enough? I mean, it's like, Sonny, will you please leave? Would you please get out of here? You're like old enough. We would love the luxury of being empty nesters. Can you just please leave? And I guess some people just can't take a hint, Danielle.
Goodness, I cannot imagine that you'd have to sue your own child to have them leave your house. This is a whole other level. I mean, I can understand wanting your adult children to leave your house, but the fact that they wouldn't leave when you suggested you'd like them to, that's quite a mind bender.
How about if we start a class action against all these kids who won't leave? It would just be so much more efficient. One lawsuit, one court, and... You know, like, I think there's a constitutional issue involved here, too. So you could do it in federal court. Everything would be fine. No, crazy.
Well, you'd open yourself up to more class action lawsuits on the way back, though, yeah. I think, against the 50-somethings who have screwed up the management of every pension and program in the world, who have wrecked the employment market so that now people can't get jobs in high school, can't get stuff on their resume, can't get started, can't get launched, can't get out of debt. I mean, I think, you know, the problem with class action lawsuits on a generational basis is there could be thick and fast.
Yeah. Yeah. It could boomerang. It could well boomerang. So maybe this kid should read this book that you have listed on your site, Move Fast and Break Things. Do you think that's what Jonathan Taplin had in mind, is getting rid of the millennials, getting them out of your house?
No, that's not what that particular book's about, but it's a fantastic book. And I've actually, it's so topical right now because it's literally, you know, he was an insider in the music industry, and he saw the migration of artists being supported by the fruit of their life's work in collecting royalties for the songs that they created and for people who create content in whatever genre. And then the Napster evolution, where things were literally stolen, content was stolen and given away for free. And to this day, you know, we have a system where much of the content in the world is taken for free and disseminated by these, you know, massive corporations, monopolies, which have gobbled up all the starters and startups in that area, whether it's Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, Expedia has been abusing power of late. I saw a story where they were blocking people from finding rooms available at a resort in British Columbia because the resort had not wanted to continue posting with them. So they literally had a blocker come up to say that there was no rooms available at that inn.
Ooh, that's
like
corrupt.
This is the kind of abuse of power which is now rampant in our system, where if you're not the customer, you're the product. In other words, if you're not paying, you're not the customer, you're the product. So the consumers think they're getting information for free when actually they're being used and abused and sold up the river in a million different ways. And the people who had the legitimate business models, who were actually, you know, providing a service and charging a transparent fee for that service, have been in many cases put out of business or reduced mm-hmm. to a margin fraction of the income they were previously collecting. And so, you know, it's, I guess history is helpful, Kerry, to me all the time, but in this area for sure, because if you look at the evolution of the corporation and not even just corporations, before corporations in medieval Europe, you had various powers that were concentrated, whether it be, you know, monarchs or land barons, whether it would be lenders who at different periods in time end up because people get into debt too much and default, and the lenders would end up confiscating all the property and farms and put everyone in prison. And then you've got an economy that's basically bust because there's no workers, there's no one being upwardly mobile. There's just wasted resources hoarded and stored by a few powers that are running the whole show. And then you get a pendulum swing where you have either a revolution or a tipping point of some kind that reverses or goes and takes those assets off of those oligarchs and disseminates it again. And usually it's a very violent chapter in history. I'm not saying it's a lovely process by any stretch, but ultimately it's an economic restart. And I think that that's where we're headed right now, because we do have, as these conglomerates in control of every major sector of the economy, fewer and fewer people receiving benefits from this particular structure, political corruption in every which way, control and capture, and basically just a weakening of the social fabric and of everything that was going well in the prior period.
Hey, you know, Danielle, since a man wrote the first IOU, it's been a pattern that's repeated itself over and over again. You've been studying the history of debt. It's in the Bible. It's in the Code of Hammurabi. I mean, you name it. Every place you look, people have been selling their souls for silver. And I mean that both literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
It's all over.
So you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, when did we get this idea of loaning and collecting an interest rate? When did we, you know, where did it come from? And it turns out that, you know, 3500 BC, in the first sort of civilization that was static in one location, they stopped wanting to migrate after food. And they figured out that if they planted things, you know, you could grow and you could harvest and the city could, or a population could stay in one place. So that made sense, but still, not everyone had seeds, and you had to sort of help people get started if they were going to be productive in the community. And so some people had the implements of husbandry and the seeds and the know-how, and they would literally advance some of that to other people and say, here, I will give you this and you have to pay me back in kind. So if I'm giving you, you know, wheat seeds, you have to give me X bushels of your crop, and that will be my payment for this advance. If I'm giving you a cow to get started, you have to pay me back in two calves over the next 2 years. That's my interest. And in the early language, the word calf and interest were actually the same word. And that made sense, right? You think, oh, well, that's actually quite smart. You know, that gets people started. It makes everyone more productive, et cetera, et cetera. The problem came when people started having bumper crops, and then they'd have too much of one thing, and they'd say, well, I don't want more wheat because I've got too much wheat already. I'd like you to pay me back in chickens. And the guy said, well, I don't have chickens. You know, well, then they started devising these tables where they'd say, we have to have some kind of an exchange where we know that two chickens equals three bushels of whatever. And so they had a whole sort of commodity exchange table prepared so that people had an idea of relative value. Over time, however, people got to a point where they wanted mostly barley and silver as the dominant commodity. And so it was like, well, you know, now I'm facing exchange risk, right? Because I'm growing wheat, but so-and-so wants to be paid back in silver. So if I have if there's a bumper crop year and the price of wheat drops, it's going to be hard for me to make my payments in silver. And that's exactly what happened. So that they got to a period where people were owed so much that they were going in and taking resources off the people who had borrowed, you know, seizing land, seizing implements and crops and animals, and putting people in prison. And that has happened repeatedly for thousands and thousands of years. I didn't appreciate common that pendulum has swung from people borrowing too much, lenders confiscating everything, oligarchs then being in power of controlling most of the resources, everyone else, you know, suffering in poverty or else in literally in prison. In Upper Canada, it was in the early 1800s, there was actually half the people that were in prison were therefore not paying their debts. And at that point, the state did not have an obligation to feed these people in jail. So it was a nightmare because the people running the jails were like, well, we have no resources. We've got all these, you know, half the people in here for owe money. And finally they said, hey, I know, let's make the creditors have to pay so much a week to feed the debtor once they're in prison. And what do you think happened then, Carrie? people said, hey, let's not put everyone in jail. Let's try and do workarounds. Let's forgive debt. Let's figure out a way to get them back functioning and producing in the economy again. And so in other periods in history, it was literally banned and illegal for, you know, whether it's in the mid, whether it's the Middle Ages or revolving about every 100 years or so, the church would ban the business of lending money. You weren't allowed to do it, period. At other times, if you were caught doing that, they confiscated your property and your buildings, and you were put in jail just for trying to collect interest on a loan. So clearly there's this, you know, wave of pro and con debt. And clearly we'd have to admit we've been through a very pro debt period, where everyone's up to the eyeballs in debt, whether it's governments or corporations or individuals, it doesn't matter. And I've been saying since 2008 that I thought, you know, you had to knock off the zeros. And indeed, in the Bible, as we've said, there's been many jubilee periods and throughout history where they did, in fact, have to knock off zeros. The complexity now, of course, and you and I were just discussing that, is that it's not just fine. You wipe out debt. The people who thought they had those assets now are reduced to zero, and the economy gets a kickstart because now people can start consuming again and not have to be paying back what they've, you know, previously borrowed. The problem with that is that the asset holders are pensions and things that people are counting on to pay them an income in retirement. And so when you're wiping out those debts now, you're not just wiping out the assets off people who in some cases have a good deal of resources and you say, oh, well, you're still relatively richer than everybody else. In this case, it's like, but who's going to provide the incomes that have been promised to retirees, et cetera? And I think that's where this one gets a lot more complex, because the answer probably is, as I've also been saying for a while, you've got to reform these whole income systems. So you can't have people expecting to get such lucrative payouts and indexed and for life, et cetera, you know, if they're retiring early. Like, we really have to kind of give from every possible way in order to get the system restarted.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just reminds me of those jubilees, the need for them periodically. And it seems to be something that we forget periodically, like every 60, 80 years we forget it. And then we get this wake up call. Now, we don't call them jubilees anymore. We call them bankruptcies, but they still happen regularly. At regular intervals, maybe 40, 80 years, you have an economic bust that's so bad that nobody can pay anything back. And then the debt gets liquidated one way or the other. And then it's on to the next. But I have a feeling when this one finally goes, you know, like you wrote Warren Buffett really sounding the alarm, this one's going to be the mother of all the mother of all busts and jubilees, perhaps.
Yeah, but the problem with Warren Buffett is, and I've written about this several times, is, you know, he's coming up to 90 and he's had this 60 year plus career. And as time has gone on and valuations have got more extreme and his fund has got huge, he has become a basically constant allocator to equities. You know, he's got lots of cash himself. He's got lots of cash coming in and wanting into his fund. He just basically buys stock and he takes concentrated positions where he's not able to easily liquidate them in any event. So really what he's become in the last 20 years is a closet indexer, Carrie. If you look at the chart of the Berkshire Hathaway fund and the S&P 500, it's basically gone up and down together in lockstep for the last 18 years. So, you know, the media likes to use him as the buy and hold guru to hammer little people into not worrying about obscene valuations. And on Buffett's own, total value equities relative to GDP metric, we are indeed a hair's breadth from the tech peak extremes, that the highest valuations ever in human history in terms of the equity market in the U.S. So, you know, he's still not saying, you know, get out. He's saying, oh, you know, things are looking pricey, but I think, you know, the U.S. economy is going to. It doesn't. It's not about the U.S. economy at this point. It's about how extreme the valuations are. And yes, the U.S. economy is due for a recession like the rest of the world, because cyclically the credit cycle has gone on as long as it possibly could. And every time that hits, you start to see the rollover and everything goes down together. But it is dangerous for individuals who are not billionaires to not understand these cycles and to take, you know, placebos from, you know, people like him who are seemingly being used to tell people not to worry, not to, you know, hold any cash, keep it all in the market and all that stuff, which ultimately just comes back to pummel them.
Yeah, ultimately, it's all very predictable, and yet it's going to come as a complete shock, Danielle, when it eventually implodes, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, in the Jubilee periods, as I said, the people holding the debt, and mostly the lowest quality debt, because there's incredible amounts of it, Carrie, the largest issuance in the last 10 years has been in covenant light loans. These are corporate debt instruments that don't have normal security with respect to, you know, contractually prescribed rates of interest, maturity dates, preference on assets in bankruptcy of the company. All these things have been waived in the low yield environment where everyone was desperate to flow money into anything and everything. And so what's happened is, you know, we always have a big default wave and we always have corporate debt sell off with equities. But this time it's particularly vulnerable. And it's the people that are holding these things thinking that that's a park for their, you know, safer money, or that it's somehow going to be defensive against any economic shock that comes, I think that are going to be in for a horrible experience.
No doubt, a horrible experience. And at this point, there's no way to avoid it, is there?
Well, there is if you sell the things and you raise your cash and you pay down your debt and you move to the sidelines and let the madness play out and hope that you can tiptoe through the tulips, so to speak, in terms of missing out on the worst of the carnage. Because, you know, you can see that it's in the asset markets and you can see that people are too indebted. But it is possible to be defensive. You just have to want to act ahead of the crowd.
Exactly. Well, what I mean is society as a whole can't duck this bullet, right?
Well, society as a whole has to restructure, I think, is the ultimate, like the economic system, the principles under which we've been living. You know, so it, originally the idea that loans were efficient for business to promote productive activity, you can see how that came from the seed use and the cattle. That made sense back then. I think the real tipping point or danger became when loans were sold to people as a means of sustaining or providing personal consumption. Because personal consumption by its very nature is not producing. It is, you know, it's used in, it's like energy being burned to keep the person alive, so to speak. It doesn't actually produce an income flow or a product for future use. And that's why there has to be a big difference between debt that's taken on to, you know, support a legitimate business purpose. And then there has to be a careful attention to how much debt is taken on and how much makes sense and where it starts to become speculative madness. But it's when people, you know, that how in The Big Short, they said that Michael Lewis wrote that he realized that the whole securitization market was about fuck the poor. That's what it was. And the thing is that it's always been about that. Selling debt to individuals and telling them it's, you know, this is what rich people do, or this is how you get rich, or this is, you know, what somehow prudent financial advice, which is what the banks and the financial companies tell people, you can borrow to do all this wonderful stuff. That has always been about wrecking the poor and taking advantage of them. So, you know, being a willing fodder, a fool, all that stuff, you don't have to be, but you have to want to see and wake up and sort of take defensive measures.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just amazing that things are allowed to get where they are. I mean, look, 40 years ago, there weren't any credit cards. You wanted to buy a TV set, you had to use the cash. You wrote a check.
Or did a layaway plan,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, layaway plan. There's nothing wrong with layaway. That's building equity. Yeah. You really had no choices. And we go back to our old friend securitization, Danielle, that makes all of it possible because it allows institutions to make imprudent loans and escape the consequences of their negligent, grossly negligent, or even criminal acts of fraud in extending those loans in the first place. Because if you knew you were going to lose the money, there's no way you would do it. And it's like, hey, we'll sell it off. 10% of them will go bad, but it's no big deal. The investors are still going to come out ahead.
And they're all taking their money up front. See, that is the flaw of that model, is that the securitization firms make commissions, putting it together, selling it, and they get their principal out, and they leave everybody else with the carnage. And that goes back to just basic restructuring we need to do in the financial system, which we've talked about before. It's actually quite simple, but unfortunately right now you've got the opposite happening again in America and most of the countries of the world, where the financial sector is back on top and they are dictating the terms. They are lobbying night and day with more money than anybody else get all any sensible regulation rolled back. And so, you know, I guess it just has to be an even bigger collapse for people to realize that they've been doing these deals with literally the devil.
It's so true. There was a guy I interviewed. He's running on the Libertarian Party to become U.S. Senator, California. And he said he was upset because he was listening to my show and I was saying, basically, there's no way out of this mess. And he said, yeah, well, we'll get our way out of it after the collapse. And I said, that's what I meant, is we can't avoid the collapse because there's no way out. And unfortunately, when you do have a collapse, you don't know what is going to be the outcome, your resulting political order. You know, the examples of history, I'm sure as you've been reading it, are replete with new political systems. The old ones swept out, even when it wasn't their fault necessarily, that they just kind of continued flawed policies. There's really no way out before a collapse. And then we just have to hope for the best that the...
Did you notice the story, though? This gave me some inkling, so to speak, of a court in Shanghai sentenced the founder of the Chinese insurance company, the one that bought the Waldorf in New York City. Do you remember that? The name of the company is not escaping me. But anyway, he was basically involved in all sorts of financialization, massive debt issuance, selling it, taking out personal funds. I'm reading his litany of crimes thinking, well, this is common in the corporate sector and everywhere else, and mostly in America for sure. And yet he was convicted and sent to 18 years in prison. And that was just this month, Carrie. So there is a tipping point, and I know that's a communist country and an extreme example, Singapore, but I'm still saying...
Singapore or Shanghai?
Shanghai.
Okay, you're right. Yeah.
I'm saying is financial crimes have been rampant and have not been prosecuted, and no one has done personal jail time, hardly anyone, just the little people. So in the next phase, part of deterrence is certainly the use of penalties. So I think that means people will go to jail, have their personal wealth confiscated, clawbacks of bonuses and executive pay. And individuals will suffer too if they lose in the asset markets, if they have their pensions restructured so they receive less income than they previously thought. But that's all part and parcel of the same bubble. And so it goes back to, you know, if you can have a shelter, if you can keep yourself in good health and ability, if you have talents that you can employ to your own support, if you have some cash savings that you can preserve in this period, you will have, I don't think the world's going to end, but I do think that we're in for this next major reset, and that would be consistent with history.
I'm inclined to agree with you, Danielle, and it's just not a question of if, but when. And as the insanity continues, we get that much closer. Anyways, make sure you go check out Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com, for her excellent and prolific content. And Danielle, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. So email us, kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Be well.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.